Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And we're happy to be back with you for another episode of War Stories. I think I'm excited for this one. I know Chuck is too. We always love when we get people from other disciplines that aren't necessarily cops or weren't necessarily just a different perspective. And this episode, Chuck has brought us Chris. How are you, Chris?
Good. How are you guys?
Oh, I'm doing well. And am I right in saying you are a fire chief?
That's correct.
Well, my training and my dad's backhand over the back of the head kicks in every time I meet a chief, and I will not be calling you Chris. I will probably just be calling you chief because you've earned that title and that rank and that distinction. So how are you, chief? It's nice to have you on the show.
I'm good, thank you.
And now tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up becoming a firefighter and rising to the level of chief. And
it's a little bit of a story. When I was about 20 years old, I suppose, 21. I'd say I fractured a law or two, but it wasn't nothing serious. Mostly just traffic laws, let's call it.
Right.
One year I got 3 speeding tickets in 1 year. So in Iowa, if you get 3 moving violations in a year's time, you could lose your license.
Oh, wow.
So I went before the judge, and judge said, well, you can do some community service to, you know, get this traffic ticket off your record. So I did. I called the local assistant chief. At the time, he was a captain. He's now one of my assistant chiefs, which is funny. He was a captain at the time, and I asked him if I could come to the fire station and wash trucks. And I had to do 40 hours community service. So I did that, and when I was all done, I asked what do I got to do to get on the fire station or on the fire department? And he said, well, fill out this application. And it was about 6 months later, I got a phone call and sat down, and the rest is history, I guess you'd say. But
you kind of fell into it.
I did. I had no interest whatsoever beforehand. In public service whatsoever. So that was 21 years ago. So
now, what was it about washing the fire trucks that got your interest in it? Was seeing the big screen TV in the recliners?
No, it was more the no,
the amount of sleeping.
It was more the people, really. Everybody was welcoming. Everybody was, you know, they're like, oh, look at this kid. You know, he's a dumbass. He did something stupid, and now he's got to come up here and watch fire trucks, you know. So, and they all remembered me, you know. I went up like 2 or 3 times a week to do it, you know. The trucks barely got used. I was washing the same clean trucks over and over, you know. So, whatever. It was what it was back then.
You know? Yeah, exactly. They were just, you know, letting you do it and signing off your hours and calling it good. Whereas if you wash police cars at a police station, like, look at this piece of crap. This kid, this guy, oh, such a dirtbag. He's going to have to wash police cars.
Totally different atmosphere.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, coming up through the ranks, you know, I started off, you know, I got my EMT, I got my firefighter training, and I started doing training at the, you know, at the department level, and that I really enjoyed doing it. So I kind of moved up to the county level, started helping with new and incoming firefighters in the county. And I did that for a while, and then actually was allowed to teach at the state level at some regional fire schools. So I was, you know, moved up to a captain's position, then assistant chief's position, and I was doing that for a while, and things went pretty good. And then in July of 2018, our present chief passed away unexpectedly.
Oh.
So, yeah, so we had that going on. He had a heart attack while he was on vacation. So.
Oh, man.
Shit, that sucks.
Right. So everybody kind of turned to me, and I guess I stepped into those shoes, when were very big shoes. So, but here we are.
Yeah. At some point you're like, wait, you guys, it's just me, right? Like what? It's like, you feel like an imposter. You're like, when's the real chief kind of come along, or when's the real? Yeah.
Yeah. We got a picture of him hanging on the wall here. And I don't know how many times I look at it and just say, I don't know how you did this. I really don't. So
he was probably saying the same thing about his predecessor.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yep.
So,
yeah. And what's that? It's like that old joke about, when you take over somebody's job and they say there's three letters in the drawer. And the first time you screw up, you open the first letter. And the second time you screw up, open the second letter. And the third time you screw up, open the third letter. You know that one?
No, I've never heard that.
Yeah. So this guy takes a job, and his predecessor says, yeah, there's three envelopes in the drawer. When you first time you screw up, open the first one. So he opens the first one. It says, blame the assistant. It was just a mistake. Then the second time you make a mistake, you open the second envelope and it says, take full responsibility and say it'll never happen again. And then the third time you make a mistake, you open the third envelope and it says, sit down and write three letters. So he was probably sitting there the whole time, wondering how his predecessor did it, and so on till the end of time.
Right.
So.
Yep.
Well, it's hard when you really respect a mentor and then have to step into their place, because you're constantly measuring yourself against them.
Right. Yeah. And it's tough, you know. He was the do-it-himself kind of guy. He never really asked for help. If you wanted to help him as an assistant chief, I had to step in and say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And, you know, so he always did everything himself. And when I went through his desk and his notes after I had taken over, I had found notes from meetings from 2014. I mean, 4 years old, for what? Wow. We don't know. He was a pack rat, too. So,
wow.
Yeah. So anyway, no, but he was a good man, and he's sorely missed around here. But yeah. So.
Well, it's under, you know, bitter circumstances that you took the job, but it sounds like if you're still the chief after this many years of stepping in, that you're filling the shoes pretty well.
Yeah.
I guess, right?
Either that or nobody else wants it, one of the two.
Well, I will say this. One of my greatest mentors, he called me when he was about to take the lieutenant's test, and he said, hey, you know, don't judge me. I think I'm going to take the lieutenant's test, and I don't want you to think less of me for it. I said, nah, just be the lieutenant you always wanted to work for. As long as you do that, I can't be mad at you.
There you go.
No. And I think we can all learn that lesson, especially, unfortunately, the dickheads that usually promote don't, but sounds like you weren't that guy.
Appreciate that.
So, we're glad to have a fire chief on the podcast, and the floor is yours. What is your story?
Well, I forwarded you guys an email. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but in October of 2014, I experienced my first plane crash incident. I wouldn't call it a stormy night. It was a crappy night, rainy and foggy. And we had a meeting at the firehouse. We were specking out a new engine, and we... it was about 11 o'clock at night. I got home and laid down in bed. And we lived next to an airport, so it wasn't abnormal to hear planes flying over at all hours of the night. It's a small airport.
like a commuter airport for private planes, or is there any commercial air traffic?
I think there's two commercial flights a day out of it. Okay. It's nothing huge. If it's big enough, they can land a 747 if they need to. I've heard that multiple times, but, so, you know, a small plane flying over is nothing out of the ordinary. So I heard this plane flying over, and, I remember it very vividly, you know, all of a sudden you hear the engine rev up, and that's completely abnormal. And you heard a thump. It hit the ground. I heard it hit the ground. So my wife shot up out of bed. I shot up out of bed. She said, "Did that plane just crash?" And I said, "I think so." And I looked out the window, and all I seen was orange glow. So it's my family. My grandfather bought a farm back in the early 80s, and he gave my dad a lot to build a house on, and then I bought a lot from him later on. So we all kind of live in the same area. That plane crashed 100 feet from his house, and I could see their house from our house. So my mom and dad's house and my grandparents' house are right next to each other. And I looked out the window, and I seen where the plane had crashed, and I thought it hit my grandma's house, you know, and I thought, this isn't good. So,
yeah, from that angle, you probably couldn't tell.
Right. I couldn't. All I seen was fire, you know, and there was probably about 200 foot long trail of fire where the plane had hit trees and it ripped its wings off. And it basically spread fuel, whatever they burn, across the ground and lit it when it hit. So I called, I, as an officer of the department, I carry a handheld radio, portable radio. And so I grabbed that. And I found out the hard way. My wife is not someone you want around in emergencies. She's running around the house. Well, what do you want me to do? What should I do? Should I call 911? I was like, just go. I got this, you know, go back to bed. So I grabbed the portable radio and I called dispatch, and I didn't know this. I thought I gave them an address, but I later on talking to the dispatcher, I told them that a plane had crashed into my grandma's house.
Well, so, I mean, they know where you live.
And so
at that point, you couldn't tell.
Yeah, they couldn't. Well, that was just like me trying to put my shoes on and trying to call dispatch at the same time. So I got back up, and they asked for an address, and I gave them my address, which was close enough. I mean, you're going to find this plane. It's 100 feet off the road and, you know, in a ball of fire. Right. So I got up on scene and I gave them the actual address of the house that it was at. Sheriff's deputy showed up, parked right where the fire apparatus. I gotta give you guys a hard time about this right now. Cops parking right in front of where you're gonna park a fire apparatus.
Normally it's the other way around, because the fire will most oftentimes beat police to a scene.
Yeah. Well, not out here with the world not out setting.
Where I was at either. No. Yep. Yeah. No, the cops beat the firefighters every time where I was at.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's like the exact opposite. Because
we were right told never house. Drive faster than a fire truck can roll code 3. That's what we were told. Never drive, especially to a medical aid.
Right. So the deputy gets on scene, and I said, I know the guy. He's actually a sheriff's deputy, the sheriff now. I went to grade school with him, and I said, "Joe, you got to move your car." I said, "We're going to park an apparatus right there now." You know, and he goes, "Okay." So I said, "Unless you're going to be stuck here the rest of the night, that truck's there, you know." So he moves his car, and I go over by the plane, and the fuselage is on the ground. It's just a fuselage, and it's a ball of wreck. I mean, it's twisted metal,
I'm everywhere. Sorry, you didn't say what kind of plane it was, right? You haven't.
Oh, I didn't. No, it was just I can't think of the name of it. It was small craft.
Like a Cessna.
Yeah.
Like a Cessna Beechcraft, Dr. Killer kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. That. So the fuselage is on the ground. And I'm walking around it, and my grandmother had actually called another relative that lives close by. He was driving through the scene on his four-wheeler, and he's like, because she called him and said a car had crashed in her yard, and it ended up being, you know, a plane. We didn't think it was a plane at first, but well, she didn't anyway. But so he got out of there, and I'm walking around, and there, well, the gruesome part was it was just a torso and a head, and that's it. outside the aircraft. So I called in the tail numbers, and everybody in the county that was listening, I didn't know this at the time, but you can look up tail numbers of any aircraft online, and it'll tell you who owns it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I called the tail numbers into dispatch because the fuselage was burning, and I wanted to get them the information before that was gone. Right. And so everybody that was listening in the county knew who owned the aircraft before we did, really, because we weren't looking that far. But so that was the on scene. You know, while we were on scene, we see these political signs laying around, and we realized who it was, and it ended up being a doctor killer, which is funny. He was an ER doctor in town, and he was running for political office. So he had flown to Des Moines for a political meeting and was flying back that night, missed his approach. Was flying by the instruments, apparently, went for another approach, came through the traffic bureau, or what is it? National Traffic Bureau.
NTSB?
Yeah, some guys. Yeah. They said that he came through trees inverted, upside down. Ooh, and so I don't know, because they said we couldn't figure out how the left wing was on the right, and the right wing was on the left, laying out in the middle of a field. So they said he had to be inverted coming through, and the vertical stabilizer was all beat up for trees from getting hit by trees. So,
I believe what happened to JFK Jr. was he was flying by instruments, and apparently it can get very hard to know which way the ground is. That's why they have that horizon instrument. And so apparently you can get inverted in an airplane and not realize it. And when you pull up, you're actually auguring in.
Right. And that's what he did. And when I heard that engine rev and before it hit the ground, all I can think of was he was upside down and thought he was pulling up and just and nosedived it right into the ground, which is exactly what happened. Cause there's a crater in the ground. It's still on Google Maps. I just looked at it half an hour ago. If you look behind my mom and dad's house, there's a crater in the dirt that's still shown there, where the plane impacted.
Right.
So yeah, it was a mess. But
Ned, did you know, everybody knew who he was? Did you actually know him personally, or is it just kind of you were familiar with him?
No, we all worked with him. He was a big part in the EMS community around here. Yeah. I worked with him personally when I was doing my hospital time for my EMT class. I worked with him, and he was a great guy. We had a guy come in and he cut his hand on a table saw. I'll never forget this. And I said, "What do you think?" I'm standing right next to him looking at the x-ray. So, "What do you think, doc?" He goes, "He's fucked." That's exactly what he said. He's fucked. He was a straight shooter, no bullshit kind of guy. And I could just imagine when he crashed that plane, his last thought was, "Well, fuck." You know? So
Sounds like he was really well liked.
He was very well liked, and there's now a memorial scholarship in his name, and so I mean he's, you know, everybody tries to remember him. You know, every year we do a banquet and stuff. So,
did you go on scene from your house basically?
Yes, sir. Right?
I'm sure you have a take home car, so you just, you know, ran over there in a take home car.
Yeah, well, in my personal vehicle.
Okay.
Yeah. Being a volunteer department, we show up in our personal vehicles, you know, not on scene typically, but because it was so close, I took my own personal vehicle up there. But like I said, I carried a portable radio, so I was able to communicate with dispatch and incoming units and stuff. So
he was the only person in the plane?
He was the only one in the plane, thank God. Yeah,
so that was the torso.
That was the torso, and he was all burnt up. You couldn't really recognize him. There was...
Yeah, jet fuel is not forgiving.
Right, yeah, yeah. It was pretty bad. It was a pretty ugly scene. We had problems with media on scene. Of course, we blocked off probably a quarter mile either direction. It was about a quarter mile either direction from the center of the site, crash site, and we had media coming through the yards taking photos. Once they found that out, of course, law enforcement took care of that, but they did get some photos with a telephoto lens, and they're on their website. They're still on their website. So
horrible.
Yeah, it's
so media, they're vultures.
Yeah, right. So
but how do you respond to a scene? So you respond obviously in your civilian car, and mm-hmm. you're wearing your uniform, and then you're waiting for assets. You're doing what you can until your assets arrive from the station, obviously.
Yeah.
And then what, how do you, if this is your first plane crash, where's your mind going? What, obviously you have to focus on who it is later and really focus on what to do. How do you process that, and what are the steps you take for something like that?
Basically what I was looking for is, once I get on scene, I'm going to communicate back, to the station what resources are needed. They were asking me how far off the road it was, where exactly it was, you know, what resources we were going to need. With it being a rainy, crappy day, like, it rained the whole day, it was muddy. If there was something off road that we were going to have to get to, you wouldn't have done it with any large apparatus with any sort of water or anything. So, but it was right in the front yard. So, yeah. So it was, just being there, you know, being the first one there. And, I don't know how else you would have responded. I mean, if that would have happened to anybody else, I think they would have done the same exact thing. You know, I mean, obviously there's nothing I'm going to do for a patient, you know, being in that condition. That was, you know, dead on arrival,
right.
Of course.
Right. But, and then you get your resources start to arrive. But do you have, like, I'm assuming that you prepare for a plane crash and you have resources for a plane crash, even if you've never handled one.
Right.
Right.
I wouldn't say, I don't know that I've ever actually trained for a plane crash. I mean, we've talked about what we would do, you know, hazardous material releases and things of that nature, you know, so basically we'd handle a fuel fire, like a hazardous material fire, you know, or, you know, a typical fuel fire. So I was calling for, burn engine, of course, ambulance, tankers, because we're in a rural fire setting. We didn't have, hydrants in that area. So we needed water tankers. So, out west, you guys call them, I think, tenders, because your tankers have wings. But
yeah, that's true. They have to.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, but yeah, I was just, you know, getting the resources that we needed coming. So,
can you guys use water, not foam?
Yeah, we got foam on board the trucks, so that wasn't. I mean, I guess they did ask how much foam we were going to need, and really, by the time apparatus got on scene, the fire was pretty well had burned itself out. Spreading that amount of fuel over the distance that it did, you know, it didn't really take a whole long of time to put out, so it pretty well burned itself out at that point.
So at that point, it's monitor it, make sure it doesn't spread, and then start a recovery.
Right, exactly.
And work with the NTSB. That's actually a question I've wondered. Who calls? Did the airport staff and the what do you call them? The FAA. What are those stupid people? Air traffic controllers that are at the tower. Do they call the NTSB, or is that something you had to do?
No, we didn't have to call them. So in our little airport, there's nobody. They staff, I believe they staff the tower from like 8 to 5. There's a radio frequency that the lights, they're off on the airport grounds. But when you come in, you click, you key the mic or something, and it lights up the lights automatically. Oh. If you're coming in at night. Mm-hmm. So they actually use Chicago Airport, their radar tower. I don't know if it's O'Hare or Midway. I don't know which one. Okay. But
I think it says in the article.
Okay. Yeah, they were talking to Chicago Airport, and they noticed it dropped off the radar, and that's when they started their channels, and they got their investigations coming. So
kind of at that point, people just start showing up and asking who's in charge, and then they find you.
Right. Yeah, well, I wasn't chief at the time, so our chief was on scene. I was actually just a captain at the time. I shouldn't say just a captain, but I was just a captain at the time. So,
but now that you're a chief, you can say just a captain.
Right. Not that there's much difference in pay.
Right.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, your guys get there, and I assume it was pretty tough, because it sounds like if this guy's tight in the local community, you guys all go to the ER on a regular basis with patients, and then, yep, you know, taking people in the ambulance and stuff like that. So this is kind of like, you know, everybody knows him.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the next step too, was calling the coroner, we call it a medical examiner here. So the medical examiner is actually a doctor or a paramedic, or, you know, they're paid for by the hospitals. And so the medical examiner was actually a close colleague of the individual that passed away at the crash. So we had to intercept her before she got to the scene, and basically seen, you know, oh my God, this is Doug's plane, you know? So, so yeah, that was another difficult thing to do. You know, there was not to be too morbid, but there was body parts everywhere. The pictures I sent you guys, you see all the traffic cones in the yard. Those are markers. Yeah. So it was a tough scene. I've never seen anything or experienced anything like that.
Yeah, that's a pretty nasty scene.
Yeah. And
their telephoto lens, you can see everything very clearly.
Yeah, they were about 350 feet away, if I think. Yeah, it was about that. About 350 feet away when they took the pictures. At 11 o'clock at night during a rain, you know, while it was drizzling rain. So
it was right clear.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that was the night. We cleaned up the next day. You know, they called in a special cleanup crew, came in, cleaned it all up. We did a critical incident stress debriefing. We have a team here in our county that comes to your department, and they talk to everybody about what happened, and, you know, tell you how to deal with the emotions that you're dealing with. And didn't really bother me, you know, that early on. I was kind of having some trouble with it. The biggest problem I had with it was that I had to drive by that scene for almost a week every day and see it, you know. So there was another doctor that was a friend of Doug's, I was told by my chief at the time that I should go to the wake. They said it'd be good closure for you, you know. I'm like, okay, well, of course it was a closed casket, you know, and there was friends and family around there. And so I went to the wake, and one of Doug's close friends came up to me, and I didn't know this. Apparently he's some sort of medium or something like that, you know. And he actually came to me and he said, I talked to Doug. Doug said, knows you're struggling with this. He says, it's going to be okay. And I'm like, what? Holy shit. That
would,
you know?
Yeah, that would be a little weird.
It was real weird. So I walked out at that point, you know, and I kind of had to gather myself up. But
that would make me angry.
Yeah, I don't know. I that was a bunch of different emotions. I didn't know how to handle that one, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how it'd feel.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, you're getting up in somebody's, like, you're getting up in so many things. You're getting up in their emotions. You're getting up in their spiritual relationships. You're getting up in their, like, thoughts. And they, you know, you're kind of doing that without permission by just going, like, man,
it's invade your privacy.
Yeah, time and place, man. I just,
Yeah. So I had that going for me. Yeah. And, I didn't really ever think, you know, PTSD was ever going to affect me or anything like that. I didn't see anybody about it. He's now my ex-brother-in-law, but I had a brother-in-law that served 3 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Marine Corps. And I kind of explained to him what was going on. And he's like, dude, he's like, that's PTSD. He's like, that's what it is. And I'm like, well, I'm going to deal with it. You know, I talked to my friends at the department and stuff about it. And when I was teaching classes, I always brought it up and I always talked about it. So it always, you know, it made it easier to get through that way, right, you know? So, but I weird shit. I was afraid of the dark. I wouldn't go into a room without turning the light on first. You know, I don't know if it was, I don't know what it was, but
post-traumatic stress for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know.
You mean why it manifested that way? Is that what you mean? Like, you don't know why it turned into?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. I don't why am I, you know, I've never been afraid of the dark, you know, even as a kid, I was never afraid of the dark. I don't know, but I wouldn't go into my bedroom at home without reaching around the corner and turning the light on first. You know, I don't know.
Were you in the dark when it all happened?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, that makes sense to me. You were like, I don't want to go into a room with the lights off. I remember what happened last time.
Yeah.
I mean, because in all reality, when you get to that level of like the reptile brain, the baser instincts, like it doesn't think like an adult human being. It makes weird random connections that you can't explain, but that are very like rudimentary in their reasoning and their logic. So ergo, you were in the dark last time it happened, and now it doesn't want to go back in the dark again.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I don't know. So store psychology.
Yeah. I went as far as putting, my wife thought I was crazy. I put a yard light up in our front yard, you know, and I was like, wow, you never know if an airplane's coming, maybe they'll see the light and they can't, you know, I don't know. It was just, there was some weird shit that I was doing. And, you know, obviously the loss of sleep stuff, you know, you couldn't turn your brain off, that kind of thing. That was typical, you know, everybody goes through that. So, you know,
You had kind of a double whammy if you think about it. And I don't want to like rush past that. I really want to really kind of recognize the fact that the first whammy is, oh shit, a plane just hit my folks' house. Right. And you're dealing with this, you know, trying to get information out and get over there and thinking you're going to find a fiery wreck of a home.
Right.
And then you get this sense of relief. And of course, we would feel guilty when we feel relieved that, you know, the person that died didn't hit our parents' home. We're like, oh, well, somebody still died. Yeah, but at least it wasn't my parents, kind of a thing. Right. But then you get hit again after you kind of settle down and realize that you know the victim and he's a good man and he's a friend of yours. And so all of a sudden this roller coaster ride of, you know, a sweet feeling of, it, well, at least it, my mom and dad are still alive, turns, you know, to bitterness in your mouth when you find out that it's not as bad as your parents, but it's close.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about weird things, like you're afraid of the dark and stuff like that. And I think that's completely normal because, you know, Tom and I have both been involved in critical incidences, which has played a big role in our life. And I'll tell you, after I got into a shooting, After all the dreams and the bad nightmares and stuff had gone away and stuff like that, I would say months later, I was afraid at night, and I would hear things in the middle of the night. I would think people were breaking into the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was completely, completely weird. So by you saying, hey, I was afraid of the dark, I mean, that's completely, that makes sense to me because, you know, I kind of felt the same way. And I thought this was completely strange. But you look back on it after you've been dealing with it for such a long time, you're like, well, I think it's going to be kind of normal now. Like that something happened, something caused a traumatic event in your life, and it's causing your brain to react in a different way. And there's so many different things that could happen. And I think that, you know, happening at night and, you know, you're going through all these emotions and everything and the adrenaline going up and down. And I think that's, you know, that's what it was. It was post-traumatic stress from that incident. And then okay to feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's been 7 years now, and I didn't think it was that long because, you know, I started going through this and writing things down so that I wouldn't forget for our meeting here. And it's as vivid as it was the day it happened, you know. So,
and then you go, God, has it been that long?
Yeah, I know. I got a newspaper out to make sure of the date, because we still have a newspaper. The whole paper is in the drawer up here at the firehouse. So,
but. Yeah, and I bet you can't bear to part with it. It's got a weird. My wife still has the front page of the newspaper that was the picture of my undercover vehicle shot to hell with all my gear all over the ground, and it just, you know, she knew I was okay, but that paper reminds her of how close it came,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So it's weird things like that, because that we hold on to, we just do, because it becomes a part of us, it becomes a weird part of our identity. It may not define us, but we certainly, we protect those things in a weird way that I can't explain, but, you know, I've had doctors try to.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, going through an incident like that, and, you know, I think it makes you stronger. I think it makes you a little harder of a person. Yeah, you know,
for sure.
You know, people kind of look at me funny. We make all of us in the the emergency services community make pretty rough jokes sometimes that
would
make other people wonder what's wrong with us. You know, I know you guys probably do too, but we all think it's hilarious.
Oh, 100%.
And I forget that sometimes, that like, even in my regular, you know, I work at a regular like corporation now that has like 300 employees, that, you know, I'm the only one among them that's been a cop. I think maybe there's like two or three military vets, and we, you know, we've talked and we've joked and we've said, but I forget, you know, sometimes I'll make a comment and people look at me like I'm a serial killer or something. You know, how can you be so heartless? How can you think of people like that? I'm like, sweetheart, do what I did for long enough and you'll get there. It's not hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I love your, some people have to hold the hand of the dog, and some people have to put the bullet in it. And, you know, and people look at me with animals, and I'm like, well, it's just a dog. Well, I don't know. I'm just a heartless asshole, I guess.
No, I loved my dog, and I was sad when I had to put him down, but I still recognize the fact that it's a dog. Like, it's my pet. Like, I love him. But the day you sign up for a dog is the day you sign up for the heartbreak of losing your dog. And if you can't get used to that, don't ever get a dog, period. End of story. Right. You know, dogs and favorite sports team athletes, like, don't get attached to your dog, and don't get attached to an athlete on your favorite sports team, because they're either going to get traded or get euthanized. And I'm not sure which is which.
Right. Oh yeah.
But I think that's a truism too. I said to some of my friends the other day, I said, you know, I understand that I'm somewhat of a cynic. I guess I'm just a cynic, and I understand that I have this kind of jaded view of life, but I hope that other people are better than me. I hope for the best out of other people. I just know that mostly their shit. And I said, what I look at people who don't feel like that or don't have that point of view. And I, you know, feel sorry for them, like, oh, you poor naive child. But at the same time, I still haven't decided if my point of view is a benefit or, you know, is it an obstacle? Is it actually harmful to me? And, you know, a couple of my friends were like, man, it takes all kinds of people. It's for one side to tell the other side that they're wrong or they shouldn't feel that way or they shouldn't think that way is stupid because you need both of them.
But sometimes I feel people who don't look at it the way that we look at it, they've never had anything bad happen.
There's that too.
Had to deal with anything like that. And they've been, is protected. And sometimes I'm like, well, sometimes I wish I was protected because I wouldn't have to deal with any of this shit. And I wouldn't have to deal with the struggles of all that. But then I'm like, well, I'm thankful for it because at the same time, I'm like, oh, it made me stronger. It made me able to look at in a different way. And, you know, when something bad happens, I don't take it as hard. But then I kind of look at it and I'm like, but I do take it pretty hard. I just take it harder than I did in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, so I get it as a kind of a good and it's a good and a bad. And
yeah,
I can't decide which is which either.
Well, you know, what's funny is I met a guy recently that I get along with. Nice guy. Same sense of humor as me, kind of same frames of reference. We're roughly the same age. We grew up, you know, roughly within 25 miles of each other. So we're cut from similar cloth, similar background, similar interests. However, he's a bit softer than I am. He's a bit more kind-hearted and tender and just a little softer. And I thought to myself that, you know, I came from a broken home. I was a latchkey kid. You know, I grew up on the mean streets of LA raising myself and luckily didn't do anything so stupid that kept me from becoming a cop. And then I spent, you know, over a decade as a police officer before I had to retire. And I guess I felt like I met the version of me that I would have been if I hadn't lived through so much life, so much adversity and seen so much hard times. And I didn't like that version of me. So there was my answer. Like, I'd rather be the me that's ready for anything. I'd rather be the me that's a little bit hardened. I'd rather be the me that's capable of taking a punch in the face and coming back at you. Even if that means I have to sacrifice a little bit of my emotional side to do it. And I guess if I look at it that way, I just think of it as a strength instead of a weakness. But I don't begrudge this guy for his upbringing and his background either. I don't want to be that.
Yeah.
Seems, I don't know.
Chris, this must have been pretty difficult for you. And it happened in 2014, December, right?
October.
October?
Is it
October?
Yep.
It's been some time. How have you, I guess, coped with it, or what helped you cope with it that you think could maybe help other people?
Talk about it. I use it as a learning tool. You know, if I'm teaching a class or if we have another, you know, another incident.
Speaking of,
hopefully it's not us. I'm not going anywhere.
Engine 51, Squad 51.
I know where that's from.
No, I use it as a teaching, you know, a teaching tool. Everybody's going to have that incident or that time in their life where, you know, I don't know. I would just say talk about it, you know.
And as you've come through this and you've talked about it, obviously, you've had time to process it. You've talked to other people who were there. You know, you've gone through it over and over and over. How do you think? Is that your dispatcher?
It's my phone telling me that there's a call.
That's awesome. Your phone tells you there's a call?
Yeah, we have a app call. It's called I Am Responding. And everybody will punch in if they're coming or not so that everybody knows who's coming.
And, oh, that's cool.
It speaks really to me. It's annoying. Cool. It's annoying at 3:00 in the morning, but my wife hates it.
Yeah, my wife would too. No, I was just going to say, so similar to Chuck's point, I guess, how have you noticed your methods of dealing with it has changed from 2014 to now, you know, 7 years later? If you've gone through that, I mean, obviously the way you deal with it and the way you process it and your reactions to it have changed over the years. Do you find it got harder at any point than it was at the beginning, or was it worse at the beginning and it's better now? I'm always curious because I find that I rode waves. Like there were times where I seemed to deal with it better, and then there were times where I seemed to be a little more on edge with certain things.
I guess, yeah, it gets easier. I mean, there's certain incidents kind of hit harder than others, of course, like you say, but I think with time, you know, time heals all wounds, right? I guess you could say sometimes, I guess.
Or at least it numbs the pain.
Right there. Exactly. Or we try to numb it with substance, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
couple
of beers.
A few beers here and there. I think time, I think it gets easier with time. I really do, you know. A few months ago, we had an incident where a 16-year-old kid took his life with a AR-15. I wasn't on the incident, but I know a few of our members took pretty hard, you know, and I came up and I sat through the critical incident debrief with them, you know, trying to support and be there for them. And a couple of the guys were fairly young, you know, fairly new on the department. So it was tougher for them. But we worked through it, you know, and I told them, I said, everybody's going to have that one incident. You're never going to forget it, you know, and it's going to come back to you. Someday something's going to trigger it and you're going to remember it. And you're going to relive it. So,
yeah. And you're not going to know when.
Right.
Now it's going to hit you right when you least expect it.
Yeah. My wife's had stuff that happened to her that I told her, you know, when we were dating, I'm like, yeah, you're not done with that. She's like, what? No, it's been a long time since that happened to me. It was something traumatic. And I was like, yeah, no, it'll come back. And sure enough, you know, it was during some raising of our children. It happened to come back. And she's like, wow, you were totally right. I'm like, yeah, it's not my first rodeo. That shit doesn't go away. I hate the idea of a trigger word and trigger warnings, because I think, you know, you can't live your life bubble wrapped from things that are going to upset you. The point is, when you are triggered, when those things do happen, to work through it. That's the time. That's the moment when you're feeling it the most is not the time to run from it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now this happened before you were a chief you're now a captain. Have you had to deal with a situation of this magnitude? Obviously, you know, you've had this recent suicide, but as a chief, have you had to really kind of guide people through a major critical incident like that? Or has it so far been mostly just the, I hate to say run of the mill, but, you know, let's face it, when you work in the fields we work in, suicide ain't something that you know, it's not rare.
Yeah. I wouldn't say they're all routine. That was, you know, in recent memory, that was probably the worst incident that we went through with that suicide. It was, you know, a small town community. It was one of our members' nephews by marriage, so which was rough on him and rough on the family, and everybody knew the family. You know, we're the biggest little town in Iowa, you know. That's the worst part about it. Everybody knows everybody. So,
yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that suicide, that one sticks out in my mind the most, you know, but we have those on occasion. We do have a lot of, our town is a small town of 6,000 residents. And, oh, yeah,
that's pretty small.
Yeah, and there's an adjacent town, which is, our borders are right tied up against each other, of 60,000. And for Iowa, that's one of the bigger towns in Iowa, or cities, they call it, you know. which is still small.
Do you guys have to go to stuff there anytime? Like if it's a major event, like mutual aid?
Once in a while. Yeah. A lot of times they'll dispatch us. We might get canceled en route because, you know, typically it's for an ambulance. Of course they're as understaffed as, you know, as everybody else in the country. So, they'll dispatch us and we'll run in. Usually it's for an ambulance calls, you know, when they've got three other ambulances, and when they're busy, we go and help them out. So,
yeah. Well, Chris, we appreciate you coming on talking about that. I admit I have never handled a plane crash. I've handled, quite a few other weird things, but never a plane crash. So I guess I'm fortunate not to have had to do that, but we did have train accidents, and I can guess that they're roughly similar minus the fire part. So I definitely can understand that. But we appreciate you coming on and talking about that. I hope that any young firefighter or young, you know, would be firefighter listening understands that you're going to see this stuff, like that's what you're signing up for. So right. Just be aware of that. And it's not for everybody. That's why there's, you know, there's all this rigorous testing. You know, that's why there's the LA Fire Department has 30,000 applicants for only 300 jobs.
Yeah. So, when we interview people, you know, we tell them, you know, we're going to see this stuff and it's going to happen, you know, so we make sure they know coming in. You know, we don't give them the details, of course, but yeah, it was pretty rough.
Yeah, I think giving them the details will, first of all, details are never going to compare to the actual real thing, right?
Yeah. Right.
So I feel like if you give them too many details, you're just going to stir them up for nothing, as opposed to just telling them, look, it's going to happen. You're not going to be ready for it, but emotionally, but you can be at least ready for it mentally. And let's just get through it and understand that you won't be the first person to deal with this. And there are other people there that have made it through it. And so will you.
Right.
Yeah. When we get new guys from the academy coming in, and I work a day shift normally now. So we see a lot of these young kids coming in, and every time I get a chance to see them or I get a group of them together, I grab all of them. As a senior patrol officer, and I look at them and I go, I'm going to ask you guys a couple questions and be honest. And I ask them, are you prepared to fight for your life? Are you prepared to take someone's life? Yep. Are you prepared to use your weapon if you have to?
Mm-hmm.
And are you prepared to fight? Because it's going to happen. And right. They look at me like the craziest eyes. And I find the ones that are looking at me like all sideways. And I'm like, are you prepared to take someone's life? And I've had a couple go, no. And I go, this isn't for you. I go, you're not going to make it if that's the way that you're going to think. I hope it changes.
Right.
Because at some point you may have to do that to protect someone else's life or your own life. And we've had a few people quit. And we've had some people that have been wanting to come on the reserves and stuff like that. And I look at them, and our reserves are different because we can have like different stages. So we'll have one, they're just kind of like helping out, getting their like credits for college. And I ask them those questions, and the next month, they're not there. They're like, no, it's not for me.
Right. Right. Well, and I think for Chris in the firefighter world, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that it's the opposite. Well, not the opposite, but it's, are you prepared to hold somebody's hand and tell them it's going to be okay when you know it's not going to be okay? Are you prepared to use your bare hands if necessary to hold somebody's face on and reassure them? You know, are you prepared to go to a call where everybody's freaking out and having the worst day of their life because somebody's dying and they just happen to be friends of yours? But the bottom line is you're there to do a job, not to be their friend. And you have to compartmentalize. Like, all those things are the same ideas, because that's a fact. That's inevitable. Just the same way fighting for your life and having someone try to kill you as a cop is an inevitability. You know, when you take on, you know, paramedic, EMT, firefighter, that's also an inevitability. And the smaller your population size, the greater the chances are that it's going to be people you know.
Right.
So, yep. Well, Chris, I want to appreciate, again, I want say we appreciate you coming on. And as always, we let our guests dedicate their episode to whomever they'd like. And Chuck told me you already have somebody in mind, or several somebodies.
The 13 members, service members that died over in Afghanistan. I think we wanted to bring their names up.
We can definitely do that. But if we didn't have that to dedicate to, is there someone that you wanted to dedicate to as well?
My predecessor, Brian Arnold, like I said, he passed away in July of 2018. Mentor, my fire chief for the first 17 years of my career here. So he was...
he was your only fire chief.
He was my only fire chief. Yeah. So we were kind of wondering how long he was going to hang in there before he died. And Mother Nature got him before he had a decision to step down. So
yeah. Well, we definitely want to recognize your former chief, but also we want to recognize, and on our episode with John came out right as this was all happening, but we had recorded it before this all happened. So otherwise we would have done it then, but
right.
Chuck, go ahead.
So as we all know that there was 13 service members that were killed overseas in Afghanistan. The 13 service members who were supporting Operation Freedom Sentinel, they died August 26, 2021, as the result of an enemy attack while supporting a non-combatant evacuation operations in Kabul, Afghanistan. The incident is still under investigation. For the Marine Corps, the deceased are Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Darren T. Hoover, 31, of Salt Lake City, Utah. Marine Corps Sergeant Johanny Rosario Picardo, 25, of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Marine Corps Sergeant Nicole L. Gee, 23, of Sacramento, California. Marine Corps Corporal Hunter Lopez, 22, of Indio, California. Marine Corps Corporal Deegan W. Page, 23, of Omaha, Nebraska. Marine Corps Corporal Humberto A. Sanchez, 22, of Logansport, Indiana. Marine Corps Lance Corporal David L. Espinoza, 20, of Rio Bravo, Texas. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Jared M. Schmitz, 20, of St. Charles, Missouri. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Ray Lee J. McCollum, 20, of Jackson, Wyoming. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Dylan R. Marola, 20, of Rancho Cucamonga, California. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Kareem M. Nakui, 20, of Norco, California. Staff Sergeant Darren T. Hoover, Corporal Hunter Lopez, Corporal Deegan W. Page, Corporal Humberto A. Sanchez, Lance Corporal Jared M. Schmitz, Lance Corporal David L. Espinoza, Lance Corporal Ray Lee J. McCollum, Lance Corporal Dylan R. Marola, and Lance Corporal Kareem M. McCui were assigned to 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines Regiment, 1st Marine Division, 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, Camp Pendleton, California. Sergeant Nicole L. Gee was assigned to Combat Logistics Battalion, 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit, 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Sergeant Johanny Rosario Picardo was assigned to 5th Marine Expeditionary Brigade, Naval Support Activity, Bahrain. For the Navy, the deceased is Navy Hospitalman Maxson W. Sovic, 22, of Berlin Heights, Ohio. He's the Devil Doc. Hospitalman Maxson W. Sovic was assigned to 1st Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division, Camp Pendleton, California. For the Army, the deceased is Army Staff Sergeant Ryan D. Knoss, 23, of Corrington, Tennessee. Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Knoss was assigned to the 9th PSYOP Battalion, 8th PSYOP Group, Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Well, rest easy, brothers and sisters. We've got it from here. And I, on a personal note, want to add that I will never stop saying that their blood is on Joe's hands. And I know Joe probably ain't listening, but Joe, shame on you. And shame on everyone in your administration, and especially screw you for the treatment of these parents at the ceremony when you met them You couldn't stop checking your watch, and you rolled your eyes at a grieving parent who said that this was your fault. If you can't take responsibility for what you've done, I don't know what to tell you, but this is his fault.
Let me,
stops with him.
Let me piggyback off that rule one quick second. This is not coming from a Republican Democrat side. This is coming from a strictly human being side. Yep. If you act like a shithead in the face of a grieving parent, you're a piece of shit.
Yep.
It does not matter what political party you are a part of, because that goes beyond political parties. This is strictly a human being, man, whatever. You are none of those. You looked at a mother who is grieving. You threw up your hands and you walked away from her. You rolled your eyes at her. And when these military members were coming off, you could not stop checking your watch. That is completely disrespectful, completely dishonorable to their service.
And disgraceful.
And regardless, just super disgraceful. Regardless of your political affiliation, that is complete bullshit, because this goes beyond that. So don't get our words twisted that we're against, you know, Democrats and we're only for Republicans. No, 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 no. This is strictly someone being a shitty human and disgracing those who have lost their life and given up and made the ultimate sacrifice for your freedoms.
Yep. So I think that about sums it up correctly. And I won't get Chris into any hot water by having him respond to or comment on anything we just said, because the opinions we just expressed are solely those of me and Chuck. But I wholeheartedly believe that they righteously should be the opinions of every red-blooded American in this country right now. And if it's not,
give me that.
get the fuck out. So on that note, the only thing I can say is, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.